Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business. From liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Johann Schmiegel, you've got the world's highest IQ.
Yes, 247.
Wow, did you know that thanks to Salesforce with Einstein AI, everyone's smarter? Now everyone's an Einstein, just like you.
But I'm the smartest.
Not anymore. With connected data and trusted AI, everyone can give customers experiences they've only dreamed of. Oh, look, here's a few Einsteins now.
Hey, hi.
Hola, amigo.
Everyone's an Einstein?
It's okay, Johann, let it happen. The number one AI CRM. Now everyone's an Einstein with Salesforce.
Hey, it's Carol and Tim.
And we have something new and exciting for you.
Everything you love about Bloomberg Radio is now in your car.
The new Bloomberg Business app, now featuring Apple CarPlay and Android Auto.
Listen to your favorite Bloomberg radio stations anytime.
Plus, every Bloomberg podcast, the latest news and more, all at the click of a button.
It's free and simple to use. Just download the Bloomberg Business app on your smartphone and connect your phone to your car.
The Bloomberg Business app, now with Apple CarPlay and Android Auto features. Download it free in the Apple App Store or on Google Play.
Presented by our sponsor, Interactive Brokers.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine. Plus, global business, finance, and tech news. The Bloomberg Business Week podcast with Carol Messer and Tim Stenebeck from Bloomberg Radio.
All right, they're out, they're maybe back in, they're not, they're now hired by Microsoft. The streaming service is already battling, probably, I'm guessing, to tell this high-tech, high-stakes story. We are, of course, talking about the palace coup that all began on Friday, led to the firing of OpenAI co-founders Sam Altman and Greg Brockman, which led to so many questions, led to OpenAI's biggest shareholder and closest technology partner, Microsoft, then Tim hiring the two to lead its new in-house advanced artificial intelligence research team.
And then you have the hundreds of OpenAI employees, including the board member that did the actual firing, then signing a letter to say that they were going to leave. So you have more than 700 of the employees at OpenAI.
Basically, just about everybody.
Almost everybody.
You can't see this on radio, guys, but for those who are on YouTube and Bloomberg Originals, these are just some of the stories that I had printed out covering everything to do with OpenAI today.
You know who spent a lot of his weekend writing those stories?
He got no sleep, man.
In your hand?
Thank God he did, because he's going to keep us all honest on this story.
Yeah, he's a one-man band and a key player to our incredible tech team that has worked all weekend to stay on top of the story. Carol, we got Ed Ludlow, co-host of Bloomberg Technology, joining us on Zoom from San Francisco.
All right, so Ed, let's cut to the chase. I'm trying to think, what's the way to think about this story that I feel like we have to constantly check the headlines to see what's the latest? How are you thinking about it? Here we are at 3:09 Wall Street time on a Monday.
Yeah, it is a full mutiny within the world's most important AI company that is completely unresolved and has massive repercussions for public markets vis-a-vis Microsoft, but also private markets. You know, there's just hundreds of millions of dollars in real time hanging in the balance on OpenAI shares, and we can get into that. But let's say I've spoken to 100 people in the last 72 hours, and this is an unprecedented story in the history of Silicon Valley in how it played out, what happened, and just how much of it is frankly unresolved. And I guess we could get to that too.
Okay, so we're going to get to where the company is valued and what happened to the share sales and the money sort of being held up that's supposed to come from Thrive and other VCs at this point. But first, I want to start with the basics, Ed. What do we know about why Sam Altman got the boot on Friday?
Yeah, we honestly don't know why. OpenAI had a very small four-person board. That board issued a statement saying around Friday lunchtime, and by the way, I was at a restaurant having lunch with an OpenAI investor.
Oh my gosh.
And the news broke. And that was a crazy moment in my career. You can only imagine. Anyway.
Was the person shocked? Was the person shocked?
We both boxed our food and ran for it, physically ran. And as you guys know, I was on TV within minutes. But listen, the board said it had lost confidence in Sam Altman based on his sort of less than candid communications with the board, without elaborating further. On Saturday morning, Brad Lightcap, who is the COO of OpenAI and remains COO of OpenAI, issued a memo to staff saying that this was a breakdown in communication between Sam Altman and that four-person board, but there was no element of malfeasance. That's the language used. What we know from sources is that there is some sort of philosophical disagreement here. Sam Altman is a product guy. He is about getting that generative AI technology into the real world, charging money for it, getting it into the hands of consumers and enterprises. The board, the four of them, are largely academics who recognize an existential threat from AI posed to humanity. And that there's a point of difference there somewhere along the way, but we don't know more than that. There's so much more to be unveiled.
Ahead, well, Greg. It makes you wonder, okay, so, you know, it makes me kind of nervous that the board wasn't able to maybe talk to its CEO right before doing this. Help me understand. Wait, go ahead. Yeah. Right?
Well, like, the chronology of it is astonishing. Sources say Sam Altman found out he was being fired as CEO minutes before he was fired as CEO. Mira Murati, who was that then the CTO, right, was informed the night before of what was going to happen and that she would become acting CEO. And what's astonishing, you know, Ashley Vance, our dear colleague at Business Week, myself, people like Dina Bass, Emily Chang, you know, we were hearing pretty early on Saturday and Sunday, then into Sunday afternoon, that the board was digging in. They were like, no, we're not caving. We're going to hire a new CEO. But the messages from the Sam Altman side were like, right up until the last minute last night, Sam's coming back as CEO. And the net result is that Sam has left, joined Microsoft, and we have a new interim CEO at OpenAI. I'm just trying to give some sense of like,
yeah,
how all of this just played in real time. And
it's rapid.
And yeah, it was rapid, but also everyone was wrong. Mm-hmm. You know, everyone, the investors that were trying to get Sam Altman back in the CEO role, were adamant that it was going to happen. Satya Nadella, who's the Microsoft CEO, was playing the peace broker, the middleman, doing everything that he could to put Sam Altman back.
Yeah.
But my understanding is the board, they just didn't pick up the phone.
I mean, I went to bed last night, Ed, thinking that Sam Altman would be back at OpenAI. After all, he tweeted out that photo of him at headquarters yesterday wearing the badge, saying it's the first and last time I'm going to be wearing this. Everyone thought, you know, because it was a visitor's badge. So then I wake up this morning and find out that he's at Microsoft. Let's correct. Go back to the, I mean, I kind of had to like check, read it twice. I was like, what is going on here? Go back to philosophical differences here, because that's a big part of this story, is the way that people think AI will play a role in our lives and humanity moving forward.
Yes.
Where does Sam Altman find himself, and where do others find themselves, and where's the rift?
So he finds himself at odds with the board. I mean, that's kind of part of why we're here. And the way to answer that question is to reflect on what happened. So Emmett Shear was installed late last night as interim CEO of OpenAI. And what sources told me and we reported is that a reason he was installed as interim CEO was that he shared with the board a recognition that advanced artificial intelligence does pose an existential threat, an X threat to humankind, otherwise known, in layman's terms, that's what it means. I'm not going to go down the whole EA route. And he shared that in common with the board, while also the board recognized that he was the Twitch CEO as recently as earlier this year, right? They felt that he could run a very large engineering team. And again, I reiterate, we actually have no idea why, the real reasons why the board fired Sam, other than there was concern at how quickly he was commercializing that AI.
So how important is Sam to OpenAI? He's one of the co-founders. How important?
The question.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's it. I think that, go ahead. Sorry,
well,
Carol.
Who owns the IP? Like, I think about that intellectual property that has so far been developed, that Microsoft has ponied up or promised to some $10 billion in it.
Exactly.
Like, who owns that?
So it's complicated. Microsoft literally owns 49% of the incorporated for-profit OpenAI, which is governed by a not-for-profit board on which Microsoft does not sit. The basic answer is that the intellectual property is the current, prior, and future generations of large language model. But this is the story, and the story of the last 24 or 48 hours has been key man risk. That investors suddenly started to recognize that if you took out Sam Altman, who is responsible for the product, flying around the world, talking to policymakers, attracting the top talent and the investors, and all of the data scientists who matter are willing to leave with him, then what's left over is that OpenAI does not have any value. The intellectual property and value is in those eggheads, forgive the phrase, that are running the place. That's what's happening here.
So we have about 30 seconds left,
sure.
Ed. Microsoft. What does he do at Microsoft? Because he just tweeted that, you know, his priority is to continue development in OpenAI, and that's a reason why he's at Microsoft.
And kiddo, just got about 30 or 35 seconds.
Yeah, the door is absolutely open to Sam Altman going back to OpenAI. Investors are still trying to make that happen. Hmm. My understanding is the paperwork ain't signed to make Sam binded to Microsoft. And I'm pretty sure Microsoft would be okay with an outcome where Sam went back. We just don't know.
So you might not get sleep tonight. Is that basically it, kiddo?
Oh, please,
I know.
Don't wish that on
Listen,
me.
I know. But we so appreciate all the reporting you and the team have done, because you've kept us smart, honest, and just up to date on this very rapidly moving and still moving story.
Take a break, Ed Ludlow.
Yeah, you are the best. Take a nap at least. 20 minutes. It revives. Ed Ludlow, co-host of Bloomberg Technology on Zoom from San Francisco. Folks, we're not going away from this story. Still more to come right here on Bloomberg Business Week.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern. Listen on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, and the Bloomberg Business app. Or watch us live on YouTube.
Staying with the story of the day, Microsoft hit a new all-time high after the software giant hired OpenAI co-founder Sam Altman and Greg Brockman to lead its new in-house advanced artificial intelligence research team. We were just talking about this with our own Ed Ludlow.
Okay, so if you're just getting up to speed, remember, Microsoft is OpenAI's biggest shareholder and closest tech partner, made at least $10 billion investment in the company. The news at the start of the year is really what got us all talking about ChatGPT and generative AI. Microsoft certainly has its own AI initiatives. Google is aggressively working on it.
Right.
Tesla does a lot with AI. So are others. With more, we got with us Crawford Delprete, president of IDC, the global research analysis and advisory firm for information technology, telecom, and consumer tech markets. Crawford joins us on Zoom from Massachusetts. Hey, Crawford, give us an idea of your reaction when this broke on Friday. This is a world that you are deeply enmeshed in. What were your first thoughts?
Yeah, oh my God. Hey, Tim, Carol, how are you guys? This was a moment, and this is a moment in tech. It was kind of a head scratcher in terms of how OpenAI could think this way, how they could think about making this rash of a move, and really how the dominoes were all lined up for if you make this move without really a concrete vision to be able to communicate why you're going in that direction, how you could end up in a situation like we're in right now, where you've got employees revolting, where you've got management shakeup, and then where you've got a possibility that Sam could end up in a different place, or in maybe a place where he could be very, very happy and do a lot of things going forward.
It has such a cinematic feel to it. Crawford, you guys advise, you do research, you do analysis. Are your clients calling you off the hook and just saying, hey, folks, it's way too early to kind of figure out what the longer term narrative is here?
Oh, of course. Yeah. I mean, I think there's a lot of need to understand and people trying to absorb this. But I think that, you know, long term, this is a time where the future of tech is really on the table. And this is not uncommon. This is not unlike what we saw in the 2000 timeframe, where leading up, where we had Netscape and we had Explorer and we had the sort of the future of the web, or not like we saw, not unlike what we saw in 2010 with the Web 2.0 companies, where you had Salesforce accelerating and you had the cloud accelerating. I think everyone knows, and all customers know, that the pieces as they move around right now are going to form the next decade or more of tech. And so I think people are just sort of watching how this ultimately plays out, but knowing that probably the landscape of tech has changed dramatically for a decade or more.
Hey, I want to bring in Rachel Metz. She's Bloomberg News AI reporter. She joins us on Zoom from San Francisco. Rachel, you were up all weekend covering this story. We read so much of your coverage and appreciate you joining us today. I want to go back to what Crawford just said, that the future of this tech is at stake right now. Give us your interpretation of what that means and sort of where the chips lie right now. Who has what and who can do and like who can use that for what tech?
Yeah, no, that's it's an issue that I think a lot of people and a lot of different kinds of companies are thinking about right now. OpenAI is by many considered to be the leader in for the hottest AI right now. A lot of large language models, generative AI in general, OpenAI is looked to as a leader. So all these employees, like over 90% of the company as of this morning, had signed a letter saying, if you don't, you know, go with our demands, we're going to... We may leave the company to affect Microsoft. Then it's a little unclear what happens to the company's technology now and in the future.
Well, how do you, Rachel, as someone who's been covering AI for us since we all went like crazy over it earlier this year on that initial Microsoft investment news, you know, it just made us sit up and take notice all of a sudden, like, wait, what is this? How did we miss it? Having said that, let's take the longer lens. Can we take the longer lens as you watch the development of AI and its impact on this world? You know, this philosophical debate that seems to be going on internally at OpenAI about the concerns, the academics on the board, the worry over its impact versus so many out there. We talked to so many different CEOs and leaders about the potential of how it can, in a positive way, maybe transform our world.
Yeah, that's a conflict that's been brewing for a while in AI in general. And I mean, it's kind of an interesting thing for technology, right? Because as you were sort of getting at there, we often think of technology, the tech industry, as wanting to push ahead as fast as possible, make things, you know, more and more advanced. Like every time there's a new iPhone that you want, you know, the latest feature is what's happening now. Whereas now we're starting to see some people that are connected to AI and AI research say, maybe we should slow down or maybe we need to slow down. And some of that sounds reasonable to some people and some of it sounds ridiculous. Depending on what kind of arguments they're making for why they want to slow things down.
Hey, Crawford, Del Pratt, come on back in here, and I want to stay on the philosophical sure. side of things. I mean, there are sort of a couple different camps right here about people's concerns when it comes to AI. Some people said, hey, we do, including Elon Musk, we do not want machines to become essentially more powerful, and smarter than human beings. On the other side, there are people who say, wait a second, that's not something we actually need to worry about. How do you characterize these two different sides? Like, play out the worst case scenario for me about what this could look like.
Well, the worst case scenario is that you've got machines making decisions at scale and humans reacting to those those decisions and not being able to govern, second guess, you know, be able to stop bad actors, not being able to discern what's reality versus what's not. Think about social media, how you get people spun up with fake images, images that look real, but they're not. You know, these are all the things that the OpenAI board was concerned about. But, you know, that doesn't mean that you can't have governance. That doesn't mean that you can't have legislation take a much, much more active role. And I think what remains to be seen is if Sam ends up at Microsoft, to what extent Microsoft will partner with governments, to what extent Google will be forced to right. partner with governments around these things to allay some of those fears.
Well, I feel like, Rachel, too, this is kind of an amped up version of like privacy concerns, right? Like we all have given incredible amounts of information to a Google, to a Meta, to a Microsoft, so much that they know about us, right? And we're all kind of, yeah, uncomfortable, but it's kind of, we need it to exist. Is that kind of where we could ultimately get to with generative AI?
I mean, look, I would say that what we're seeing for a number of people that are saying we need to like slow down the pace of AI technology, they're not talking about privacy risks so much as they're talking about things like potential extinction, risks like maybe AI that will get so good that it will kill all of us, that sort of thing, which some people say is a real risk, but a lot of people say that's ridiculous. So I mean, I think that we have to sort of like keep that in mind when we're thinking about what the people who want to slow this stuff down, what some of them are thinking, which is that they some of them truly believe that AI is going to potentially kill people. And, you know, an existential risk is you could see how, you know, that you kind of go in that path. And you're like, oh, wow. Okay. Yeah,
that'll creep you out. Hey, Crawford, got like 25 seconds. The clients that you work with, are they more enthused? Are they more worried about OpenAI and generative AI? Real quickly.
I think that most of the customers that we talk to are looking at it as an opportunity. They're looking at it as an opportunity to increase productivity. To give people skills that they never had before. But they are asking a lot about the security is tops of the list. Privacy is second on the list of things that they are most concerned about. They are taking an optimistic view. But definitely, I think, need the governance.
All right, guys, thank you so much. Crawford Del Pret, president of IDC. Rachel Matz, Bloomberg News AI reporter out there in San Francisco.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing, entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So, there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
Attention campers, the new Camp Snoopy at Kings Island brings your family summer camp fun all season long. Head to Camp Snoopy with Charlie Brown and the whole Peanuts gang for fun and adventure. Race forwards and backwards on the new family boomerang coaster, Snoopy Soapbox Racers. Explore on your own with more space to roam at Beagle Scout Acres. And don't forget to grab a snack at Pigpen's Mess Hall. It's a new way to play with the Peanuts gang at Camp Snoopy. Now open, only at Kings Island, for the fun of it.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern on Bloomberg Radio, the Bloomberg Business app, and YouTube. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
Hey, Carol, in 2021, more than 200,000 Americans got these letters from the Social Security Administration. These letters said that, hey, we overpaid, and you actually owe the Social Security Administration money.
So people had to pay back the Social Security Administration.
Well, if they didn't pay, their benefits would be cut off until the Social Security Administration gets its money back.
All right. This is all according to our next guest's new book. It's fascinating. Social Security Horror Stories. Protect yourself from the system and avoid clawbacks. This story, by the way, was the top of a 60-minute segment earlier this week that included Lawrence Kotlikoff. He's the co-author, Tim, of the book, along with Terry Savage.
Hey, it's good to have you back with us, Lawrence. He's also, we should note, a professor of economics at Boston University, a fellow of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, and a research associate at the National Bureau of Economic Research, among many other things. Carol, I actually left a lot of stuff out of
his bio.
He's
written a ton of books.
20.
He joins us on Zoom from Boston. So great to have you back with us, Larry. I hope this finds you well. Let's get to the crux of it, because it is fascinating. It's also terrifying. You've also, though, been writing about the Social Security system for years. Why has this continued to generally be on your radar and a target, a topic that requires examining, in your view?
Well, it actually turns out there was testimony by the acting commissioner in front of Congress a week or so ago, and she confessed that there's a million people being clawed back each year. So I've been writing about these horror stories. I've been calling them horror stories. I wrote on PBS NewsHour and Forbes for years. I've been writing, because people were asking me questions about Social Security and telling me this. And then I wrote another book called Money Magic, which Terry Savage is my co-author on this new one. She interviewed me, and then we became kind of friends. And she started sending, she's a CBS News reporter in Chicago, and she started sending me questions. And I said, well, these horror stories, I've been writing about them. And then I said, Terry, let's do two things. Let's have you in your outreach, ask people to send in their stories. And if we get a lot, well, let's put them together in a book. Within a couple of weeks, we had over 150.
Wow.
And she knows that there were CBS contacts to people at 60 Minutes. So bingo, we were on 60. So it's been there. It's been there going for years. It's just that things came together that we could actually get this into the public attention. And then we decided we would write this book and bring it out at the same time.
We only have about 6 minutes or so. So get to the heart of like what's happening.
What's happening is that there are Social Security is making mistakes, and their mantra is your mistake is our mistake. I mean, our mistake is your mistake. And so they can overpay you for years on disability benefits, on your retirement benefit, on your spouse benefit, on whatever, child benefits. And they are making a mistake. You don't know it. You're thinking you're getting the correct amount. And then 15 years later, you get a bill in the mail for $110,000 or $50,000 or $25,000. But it's usually quite big. I've seen bills as large as $304,000. They have no clue what they're doing, really. The system is so complicated. The manual, the handbook, the manual, operating manual goes 20,000 pages. Covering 1,227 rules that are in their handbook about 12 benefits. So it's complicated beyond belief. So they make mistakes all the time, and then they don't catch them, and it's your fault.
Lawrence, you argue that the onus is on us to actually make sure that we're being paid the right amount, given that the Social Security Administration has made and continues to make so many mistakes. What do people listening and watching us right now need to know about how they can make sure that they're not going to get one of these letters?
Well, one of the things I've done over the years is to produce a software tool called MaximizeMySocialSecurity.com. MaximizeMySocialSecurity.com. We write about it in the book, but it's been there for years. It's $39. People can go and check that they're getting the correct benefit. If they're being overpaid, they can.
But can I just do that by logging into the Social Security Administration website and creating an account there?
No, because they're not asking you. Those calculators there that they have are very primitive and make crazy assumptions. And, it's not even clear that they're. So I would say the answer is no. I would say the software that we have is far more accurate. We've actually corrected some of Social Security's own benefit calculations and gotten them to fix their system using our software. So
help me understand, though, in terms of these overpayments that kind of go undetected for years, and then all of a sudden individuals get something from the Social Security Administration saying, hey, by the way, we overpaid you and you owe us a chunk of money. And sometimes, as you said, in cases, it could be more than $300,000. It's a lot of money. Help me understand the overpayment. Was it a slight overpayment, extreme overpayment, where somebody who was getting a check might have said, wow, why did that go up so much?
Well, I'll give you an example. Lady becomes disabled. She writes a child's book. It becomes a bestseller for a number of years. She starts getting royalties. And then she calls every year and says, listen, I'm getting these royalties. Can I still get my disability check? They say, no problem, it's royalties. Then she gives a talk or two at a local library. They send her a 1099 for the expense of going to whatever, parking or travel. And then Social Security changes its mind 10 years later, says all those disability benefits we've been paying you for all these years, they're actually earned income because you actually took steps to sell your book. You gave these two talks, and therefore you owe us $304,000. And then she appeals. The administrative law judge says, well, it has to be our mistake. It is our mistake, but also you have to be poor. And I've looked at all your financial records, and guess what? I've looked at your cable plan, and you have lots of TV stations. It's a very rich plan, very good plan, and therefore I've decided you're not poor, and therefore you have to pay back the 304 $1,000, or we'll just continue not to pay you your check until the rest of you, until you die.
So you're saying they say, hey, it's okay, you should get these benefits, and then all of a sudden they kind of change the rules. Is that fair to say?
They can change the rule. They can change their mind 45 years later. We've seen clawbacks going back. Somebody was a 40, you know, 65. They're being clawed back for $175 because they got a child benefit when they were for one extra month when they were 19, because they were still in high school, and Social Security got wrong when they actually graduated high school. I mean, it's horrendous, and it's not just the disabled. We're talking about a million people a year for all kinds of reasons. And it's all basically all mistakes from Social Security that they're charging us with.
I know in the 60 Minutes piece that the individuals that were profiled, they actually, I think the Social Security Administration, I think Anderson Cooper at the end of the piece said, listen, they basically forgave their debt and they were looking into it as well. Is there anything that has moved forward in terms of Social Security and how they are managing things? And I'm wondering what you think is the problem. Is it mismanagement? They don't have enough people. They don't have good technology. And my apologies, because I know this is not an easy fix to this situation, but we only have about a minute left.
Well, Social Security has changed its philosophy internally, and it's let's go get every single penny because we're broke, although the clawbacks collectively are about $21 billion that they're going after compared to a $65.9 trillion unfunded liability. So it's peanuts. And they're putting all the, you know, 77 million recipients under threat that they could be next or their relatives because they have to pick up the slack if their brother, whatever, gets hit. So I think it's people at the top who just don't give a damn. There's an overarching, the reason that those three people were forgiven is that there's an overarching principle that Social Security can waive these clawbacks if it goes against equity and good conscience. That's in the law. So the commissioner, the acting commissioner today could just say anything beyond 18 months, it's on us. That's it.
Well, and they could do Well, very interesting. There's a lot more in your book. Larry Kotlikoff, thank you so much. Professor of Economics at Boston University, his book, Social Security Horror Stories.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern. Listen on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, and the Bloomberg Business app. Or watch us live on YouTube.
Well, the Bloomberg U.S. Aggregate Bond Index, it tracks about $25 trillion of investment-grade government and corporate debt, gained about 1.4% last week. It's up 0.5% for the year, and that's after we got softer-than-expected inflation data. That index, by the way, we should note, posted a record loss of 13% in 2022.
Okay, so let's look into our crystal ball and figure out what 2024 has in store.
All right, Wizard Stenebeck.
2023 is not even over yet, Carol, but we're already looking ahead. We've got Leslie Falconio, head of taxable fixed income strategy at UBS Global Wealth Management. She joins us on Zoom from New York City. Good to have you with us, Leslie. So give us an idea of what we can expect, not just in the year ahead, but just in the next 6 weeks as we wrap up 2023.
Right. Well, let's start with the next 6 weeks first. I mean, you know, as you know, we've rallied quite a bit from the October level of 501 on 10-year yield. I mean, as you mentioned, right after that CPI number, you know, we had a really large move. The market is pricing in and pushing forward now some easing from the Fed in 2024. Now we have, you know, a 35% chance that they start in March. The easing in 24 has been priced into 100, you know, to about 100 basis points. You know, we think that's a little bit overdone. You know, for the rest of the year, we have the Fed on December 13th. We still have another inflation number. We have another payroll number. So, you know, I think there's a bit of FOMO out there in terms of if you don't lock in right now, even though our view is no question that yields will be lower in 2024. We think around 3.5 to 3.75 going into near the end of 2024, but that's not necessarily a straight line. And so we've seen a bit of this loosening of financial conditions, the equity market doing well, and a bit of reversal from the last time the Fed met back, you know, a month or so ago. So, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if we saw a little bit of rise in interest rates in the short term, but for, you know, in 24, there's no question yields are lower.
Well, one thing I would say, Leslie, if anything, you know, fool me once, shame on you, fool me twice, because I feel like we've had some fake outs when it comes to the Treasury trade, and there's either enthusiasm in terms of, you know, or expectations that rates stay higher for longer, as the Fed has certainly lectured us about for a long, long time, you know, or all of a sudden we move in the other direction. The volatility that we can see in this market, can kind of give you a bit of whiplash.
No question. I mean, just look at even look at what happened with the 2-year. I mean, the 2-year moved last week around 20 basis points lower, right? That was like the biggest move that we've seen since SVB. So there's no question. There's a lot of volatility out there, but there's volatility because this is a show me market. And, you know, with, you know, Chair Powell kind of having the sort of wait and see type of rhetoric, you know, you're sort of moving on every number. When CPI was so weak, the market really adjusted really quickly. When claims came out weak, the market adjusts quickly. And now that, you know, we're sort of through that, if in fact we have the next CPI, we have a reversal, then you're going to have a definitely different outcome than we're seeing right now in terms of treasury yields.
Well, I'm so glad you brought that up, because it does seem like, you know, this was kicked off with the ever so slightest, you know, downside surprise when it came to jobs, when it came to CPI. What happens if we find out that, you know, inflation's a little stickier, getting from 3 to 2% than people thought?
You know, and I think that's very valid. That's why we don't think that the Fed really doesn't start to ease until the third quarter of 2024. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, it's probably in his best interest right now to sort of keep that higher for longer kind of mentality for, you know, the first half of 2024, unless, of course, we see a negative payroll print or we see a large decline in confidence. But otherwise than that, there's really no reason for them to ease in March, right? So that higher for longer will be there for quite some time. And I think that the market is just getting a bit, you know, over its skis right now, temporarily in terms of yields, but overall, we think yields will come down. But it's too soon to say or wave a victory flag, right?
But not too soon to lock in.
We've seen this before.
But not too soon, in your opinion, to lock in some of these yields.
You're absolutely right, because I mean, when you think about, you know, when you get to that 5% 10-year yield, or even where we are right now, around that 4.5%, you know, that compounding income is a huge tailwind to total return, and that's really what we're thinking about. I mean, you know, the amount of that yields need to rise, right, for you to have a negative return is, you know, 60 basis points. It's quite a bit. And I know you were talking about earlier about the ag and what happened with the ag in 2022. Cool. And I think that's one of the valid points, is that, you know, everyone says, oh, could this be the third consecutive negative return of fixed income, right? But you were starting a base case of 50.
Why buy the 10-year for 4.42 when you could buy the 2-year for 4.91?
Because you have that, you know, price appreciation by locking in and taking some interest rate exposure here. I mean, if anything, you're going to see that 2-year, which I'm sure will decline, but I don't think you're going to have that kind of, you know, inflation appreciation that you're going to have by locking in some interest rate risk here, particularly given where we are in the cycle.
Any more on the shorter? What you're saying is no more that appreciation on the shorter duration?
I think you could have it, but you're not going to have it compared to what you're seeing in sort of that longer end of locking in, right? Because if they start to ease, they're easing because the economy is slowing, right? And which we think is going to happen. You'll definitely have that long end coming down. And as we know, you know, over the past 40 years, when the Fed pauses, right, interest rates come down, both in the short end and in around that 10-year. Mm-hmm. But having that interest rate risk now on top of compounding income is great for future total return.
So we had an auction today, strong treasury auction.
Go ahead. I was going to say that's really important too, because, you know, obviously there's a bit of angst with that 20-year, given what happened with the 30-year.
Right.
I mean, with that 5 basis point tail that we saw on the 30-year auction, there's a bit of anxiety with that 20-year, because first of all, the 20-year doesn't have the same sponsorship to begin with.
Right.
As you would as a 10 and a 30. Mm-hmm. Combined with what happened in the 30-year auction, there was a bit of anxiety, but actually it went quite well.
So, okay, real quickly, just about 40 seconds, see a recession next year? You're saying we don't cut rates until the third quarter of next year. Will there be a recession? Is that your expectations as part of the view? Just quickly.
No, it's not. We don't have a recession view. We think a slowing growth view, but you know, the ease will be simply because we think inflation's coming down and growth will be below trend, but not recession.
All right. Interesting stuff. Listen, thank you so much. Leslie Falconio, head of taxable fixed income strategy at UBS Global Wealth Management. I meant to ask her some questions for my cousin's husband, David, because we've been talking about that taxable fixed
This is market. Like a theme today. We keep like having these extra questions. Let's get her back.
Relating back to my family stuff.
We'll get her back.
What's interesting, we should mention Richmond Fed President Tom Barkin saying that progress isn't sufficient enough for the Fed to declare victory on inflation. So, folks, we're not there yet.
We know that.
We're not there yet.
2%. Of
not
course
there.
That's the case.
Patience. Not there. Just saying. Just putting it out there. This is Bloomberg.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline. It's teamwork. And it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest-growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle-market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at stiefel.com. That's STIEFEL.com.
Stifel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
Attention campers, the new Camp Snoopy at Kings Island brings your family summer camp fun all season long. Head to Camp Snoopy with Charlie Brown and the whole Peanuts gang for fun and adventure. Race forwards and backwards on the new family boomerang coaster, Snoopy Soapbox Racers. Explore on your own with more space to roam at Beagle Scout Acres. And don't forget to grab a snack at Pigpen's Mess Hall. It's a new way to play with the Peanuts gang at Camp Snoopy. Now open, only at Kings Island, for the fun of it.
I'm driving in my car. I turn on the radio.
How about you let me drive?
Oh, no, 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 no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I want to drive.
Keep driving.
It's the question that drives us.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
TikTok, everybody. What do we got? About 17 and a half minutes left in today's trading session. We got an equity rally underway. It's an interesting week, holiday shortened trading week because of Thanksgiving. There is some trading, a shortened day on Friday. We have some economic news. What are volumes?
Volumes are higher today.
Well, maybe people came in. Maybe because of
on the NASDAQ, I should say. The NASDAQ and the Dow volumes are higher. S&P volumes are lower.
Lower? Okay. Yeah. So, but I think we're on track for, is it a fourth week of gains?
Yeah, this would be a fourth
for the
week
S&P
of gains,
500
yeah.
weekly?
Yeah.
So pretty significant. All right. So let's see what our guest has to say. Our drive to the close. It is certainly on. With us is Greg Halter. He's director of research at Carnegie Investment Counsel. They've got about $4 billion in assets under management. He is on Zoom from Cleveland, Ohio. And I just want to mention that the company, Carnegie Investment, it's a registered investment advisor, and they're also a wealth manager. Hey, Greg, welcome. How are you?
I'm doing fine. Hope you are as well.
We are. We're, you know, trying to keep up with the OpenAI story. Is that something that you guys, I don't know, think about, talk about on a Monday for fun? Or is it about something you talk about from an investment perspective?
Probably both. Lots of events over the weekend for sure with Sam Altman. And I just heard on your news piece there, 700 are threatening to leave. We're seeing Microsoft driving to a new high, NVIDIA, which reports this week as well. So definitely it's water cooler chat as well as real business in regards to what Microsoft is doing by hiring Sam.
Does anything concern you about this story? We spent a good portion of the beginning of our program talking about philosophical differences between Sam Altman and others on the board of OpenAI with regard to guardrails. In terms of how you're thinking about the technology as an investor, does anything give you pause?
Yeah, it's obviously a potentially and probably contentious area. There's some who think that AI can go too far and potentially ruin the world. Others are looking for the benefits in terms of business, productivity, and so forth. Remains to be seen how all this plays out. There's certainly incredible benefits that can be had if handled properly. So I think that's the main crux of the issue here is how this plays out over time. And really, we're talking about 1 year since the ChatGPT came onto the scene.
Right, January, right, of this year, that big investment by Microsoft. Where we're all like, wait, what's going on here? Hey, you said, I feel like, first of all, Greg, that when there's money to be made, investors are like, yeah, I got some concerns, but how do I make money? So how do I make money off of this? You said that there's real business. It's not only water cooler talk today. It's real business. So, you know, are investors calling you guys up and saying, you know, increase my position exposure to Microsoft, NVIDIA? Is there a private market folks or, you know, who are saying, how do I get in on the OpenAI side of it from a private market perspective? What is the real business that's coming off of this for you guys today?
Very good question, Carol. And we have had clients call and ask us what we're doing in this regard. I think a lot of investors have lots of questions and are confused on exactly what it is. Our stance has been, rather than go with the more speculative companies that really don't have revenues yet, we're looking at the Microsofts of the world and Amazon and NVIDIA, the companies that make the chips and the data centers. So Eaton providing the electricity and the electrical power into that area. Those are the ways we're playing this, the more established companies.
I want to shift gears a little bit and sort of zoom out. Well, Carol, you wanted to
You said Eaton providing the power, meaning what? Wait, help me here.
Sure. Eaton is a Cleveland company, actually not too far from us right here. And they are huge into the electrical business. So everything from soup to nuts in terms of regulators, and you know, their backlog is huge, and it's out into multi-years now. So Eaton's products are needed for these data centers. The data centers are what are crunching all this data. AI is probably tenfold, at least fivefold increase over what we have currently. So Eaton is a huge player, huge beneficiary of that, as long as this trend continues.
It is a $90 billion market cap. You're right. We don't necessarily talk about it day to day. And it is up about 45% this year. This speaks to, it's like, I feel like when it was either content and folks were like, I don't care who creates the content. I want to be the pipe that gets it into everybody's home. And that's what it sounds to me like right now. Artificial intelligence, whether we have problems with it or concerns about it, probably here to stay. I don't kind of necessarily know who's going to be leading with it, but if I can be the backbone or the infrastructure, I'm in it.
Right. It's the so-called picks and shovels approach to the gold rush, or the Levi's jeans approach, right? Okay. So let's talk more of those, Greg. What else do you have for us? You've got Eaton that Carol just mentioned, that you just mentioned. Then there are the big players like Microsoft, like Amazon, like NVIDIA. Who else is out there that could be, that or is on your radar?
Sure. There's some other companies that I think investors wouldn't really think of, but Accenture, ACN is the symbol there, in terms of the consulting. All these companies want to deploy AI, but how do they do it? What's the best way? Accenture is a huge consultant, and they will be one area we think will benefit from that.
It's funny you say
Broadcom.
That. Accenture hitting a 52-week high today. Shares up so far this year, 24%, Carol.
That's pretty fascinating. It's funny, you know, Greg, very early on in my career, it was like the beginning of the mutual fund industry. And that's how we would play it with our host. It's like something would happen in the news world. And it's like, okay, so how do you buy it? And I always throw out this example. It was like, unfortunately, there could be a hurricane or devastation. It'd be like, okay, people are going to be buying the cement, you know, companies. We think about, we're in wartime, the defense companies, right? Like you look at them right now. And I feel like that is kind of the smart way to be looking at this news at this particular time in terms of OpenAI.
No question. I mean, here's another one. Stryker is going to be using AI in the future of its implants. And, you know, from personal experience, I'll be having a hip replacement in 10 days. You know, there will be using the Mako robot. Wow. Stryker is at the cusp of all kinds of innovation, and they will be deploying AI in that space as well. So these are all to make these procedures easier, faster recovery. I mean, that's huge for someone who's undergoing that type of procedure.
Really smart way to look at this story. Can't tell you how much we appreciate it. Greg Halter, Director of Research at Carnegie Investment Counsel. We mentioned $4 billion in assets under management. Happy Thanksgiving, Greg. Thank you.
Yeah, and so good luck on the hip surgery coming up 10 days away. Hope you have a restful time and you're back on your feet and back with us too very soon, Greg. Appreciate it.
Absolutely. Well wishes to him in that journey. All right, you are listening and watching Bloomberg Business Week. Carol Masser, Tim Stenovic, and this is Bloomberg.
This is the Bloomberg Business Week podcast, available on Apple, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts. Listen live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, TuneIn, and the Bloomberg Business app. You can also watch us live every weekday on YouTube and always on the Bloomberg Terminal.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Attention campers, the new Camp Snoopy at Kings Island brings your family summer camp fun all season long. Head to Camp Snoopy with Charlie Brown and the whole Peanuts gang for fun and adventure. Race forwards and backwards on the new family boomerang coaster, Snoopy Soapbox Racers. Explore on your own with more space to roam at Beagle Scout Acres. And don't forget to grab a snack at Pigpen's Mess Hall. It's a new way to play with the Peanuts gang at Camp Snoopy. Now open, only at Kings Island, for the fun of it.